Last time, I pointed to several strange patterns in our ordinary intuitions about knowledge, and I promised you that I was going to do something about them. So starting today, we're going to be breaking into the black box that generates these patterns. We're going to look at the proximal mechanisms that drive our pursuit of knowledge and enable us to detect it in each other. Many of these mechanisms are specific to human beings, but some of them are shared more widely, including the one I'll be talking about today. According to Aristotle, all men, by nature, desire to know. According to me, it's not just men. Curiosity, which is still characterized by at least some contemporary cognitive scientists in a very Aristotelian way, as the intrinsic desire to know. That's Jacqueline Gottlieb and Pierre-Yves Houdier. Curiosity is evident in humans of all sorts from early in infancy. And I recommend especially the work of Tania Lombroso on that point. It is said to appear in other animals as well, certainly other primates, many species of birds, rats, octopuses, some say fruit flies. I don't have to go that far today, but you can ask me about them in question period if you're curious. What is it to be curious? To say that curiosity is an intrinsic desire for knowledge is to say that the curious animal somehow desires knowledge for its own sake and not just for the contribution that knowledge makes to the pursuit of other ends, such as nourishment. Putting it that way, one might wonder how and indeed whether curiosity really shows up so broadly among animals. I mean, what does an octopus want with an intrinsic desire for knowledge? If that even is the best way of explaining its exploratory and playful behavior. Look, even if there are many things that octopuses must know in order to thrive, we might wonder whether they couldn't just learn those things through trial and error processes driven by simpler incentives such as hunger. The suggestion that non-human animals are pursuing knowledge for its own sake might sound somewhat silly. And yet, several lines of evidence arguably point in that direction. So two important strands are outlined in a classic paper of Daniel Berlin's from 1966, which has the wonderful epigram, "Animals spend much of their time seeking stimuli whose significance raises problems for psychology." Those pesky animals, at it again. First, Berlin observes that playful and exploratory behavior emerges too early in development to be explicable by its association with the satisfaction of other basic needs. And secondly, he notes that animals will sometimes attend to novel and complex stimuli, even when it's hazardous to do so, and even in preference to the satisfaction of immediate thirst and hunger. Curiosity seems to have some kind of independent weight of its own, a finding that he describes as somewhat embarrassing to mid-20th century theories of motivation, which attempted to explain all behavior in terms of the pursuit of physical gratification and the avoidance of physical pain. Some embarrassment still lingers around curiosity now. It's customary for every psychologist to open their review on curiosity with some kind of lamentation about how the field is not in consensus about what curiosity even is. My theory is that the deepest problem here really is a problem about curiosity's target. What is it aimed at? It's hard to see how an octopus could want something as abstract as knowledge in the way that it clearly wants to eat a clam. Peter Carruthers has actually voiced a really good, sharp version of this challenge, right? He's suggested, he accepts that many animals are curious. And he argues, look, a desire for knowledge should be impossible for animals lacking the metacognitive reflective ability to conceptualize that mental state. And Berlin himself wouldn't have described animals as seeking knowledge. So Berlin has a sort of two-level theory of curiosity, where there's the lower level information-seeking perceptual curiosity, and then a higher level epistemic curiosity, which he thinks is uniquely human. He says humans have both. The animals just have that lower level information-seeking type. Epistemologists might think Berlin is getting that result partly because of the way he's defining knowledge. He defines knowledge as information stored in ideational structures, which is a little bit fancy. And you might wonder if another definition of knowledge would give him the result that animals are seeking it too. Meanwhile, actually, among contemporary empirical researchers, many take all curiosity to be directed at knowledge. I have kind of a list on your handout of who does what. So we see a bunch, this is under two on your handout, seeing curiosity as aiming at knowledge. Others, Christopher Shee, Linda Smith, speak in terms of drives or desires for information. A very popular thing is to have some kind of mashup of these two things. So Lau and colleagues define curiosity as, quote, a reward learning process of knowledge acquisition or information seeking. Kidd and Hayden say it's a drive state for information whose purpose is to motivate the acquisition of knowledge and learning. And the relationship between knowledge and information is typically left unexplained in this literature, and sometimes when they do explain it, you sort of wish they didn't. So we have David Silver, who's wonderful, of course, saying we define knowledge as information that is internal to the agent. And if that sounds strange to you as an epistemologist, brace yourself. There are other moves which can sound even stranger. So the very influential paper by Baldassare on intrinsic motivations like curiosity, characterizing them as, quote, based on mechanisms that drive learning of skills and knowledge, okay, so far, on the basis of the levels and variations of such skills and knowledge directly detected within the brain. So the suggestion that levels of knowledge can be directly detected within the brain might sound especially jarring to epistemologists who see knowledge as a fact of mental state, a state whose objective reality matching correctness is its essential core. So people like Williamson here. Whatever curiosity researchers mean by this word knowledge, you might suspect it's got to be really pretty far off from what we mean by it as epistemologists. But today, I'm going to argue that the best way of understanding knowledge actually works for both sides. If we characterize knowledge as the most general fact of mental state, we can explain how it's possible for unreflective animals to have an intrinsic desire for knowledge. And at the same time, empirical models of natural curiosity can clarify what it even means for knowledge to be a fact of mental state, a state of a type that can only bind an agent to truths. I think research into animal curiosity, together with related models in reinforcement learning, can show how knowledge functions as a type of adaptation of the agent to reality, an adaptation resulting in a type of mental state whose very existence depends essentially on the truth of its contents. What curiosity does is it accelerates that adaptation by making it a direct target for the agent, rather than just having it be a byproduct of the agent's quest for other goals. However, it's going to take some work to explain how this happens and why it is that our cognitive adaptation to reality needs acceleration. It's also going to take some work to clarify the relationship between information and knowledge. As an initial step, maybe it'll help us to focus on an example of Jürgen Schmidhuber's, this is from the 2010 paper. There's references at the back of the handout if you want to look at them. And this involves a vision-based agent who stumbles upon a television screen that is broadcasting just random white noise. This display, completely random static, is terrifically information-rich in the classic signal detection theory sense. So this is a sense of Shannon, 1948. At each moment, at each frame refresh, the exact pixel configuration that you get is one out of a vast, vast number of possibilities, and, because this is all random, it's entirely unpredictable from what you had in the last frame. Regular patterns, like if you just had a pattern of it, like stripes or something like that, those have regularities that enable the signal to be compressed. You can crunch that file down with some mathematical description of the pattern and transmit it with perfect fidelity. The maximal disorder in the white noise means that if you want to copy that signal, the only way to do it is with a file size exactly the same size as the original. No compression is going to be possible. So that's maximal information right there. Black screen is minimal information. It's just zero. Schmidhuber's points out, if curiosity were just a drive to lap up raw information, curious animals should just love staticky screens. If you don't, Schmidhuber suggests, the reason is actually that there's no patterns that the agent can make progress in coming to know, in compressing, no regularities that the agent could come to know. And actually, he thinks that idea applies to not only the maximal information side, but also the minimal information side of the spectrum. You're looking at a completely black screen. There also, you can't make progress in mastering this, in compressing it, right? You learn the regularity right away, and there's nowhere to go from there. So what curious agents seek is not just raw information, but information at a level that poses an appropriate challenge to their current cognitive powers. Articulating exactly what that level is, that turns out to be a difficult problem, and a problem central to understanding the nature of curiosity. I think the white noise example doesn't show that cognitive scientists are wrong to describe curiosity as involving information seeking. But it raises questions about what kind of information is sought and how. To answer these questions, we need to look at a larger framework, incorporating the relationship between the powers of the agent and the features of the environment that are producing the informative signals, plus systems in the brain that produce metacognitive signals about the agent's level of adaptation to reality. With this larger framework in view, we can make sense of curiosity as a state aimed at knowledge gain. So I'm just going to give you a quick advanced sketch of the main ideas here. If this is all a little baffling, don't worry, we're going to walk through it slow, but I just want to give you a feeling of where we're going. Our most basic form of learning is a kind of prediction error correction. And because of that, creatures like us gain knowledge when we make prediction errors. That is, when we are surprised, when events violate our expectations. Following a cue from research and reinforcement learning, we're going to examine the proximal signals behind natural curiosity, well, actually formulated as a kind of appetite for surprise. Surprise functions as a reward for the curious creature, in a technical sense of reward that I'm going to explain. But because creatures like us gain knowledge from surprising situations, curiosity ends up amounting to a desire for knowledge gain, or so I'm going to argue. The resulting theory has broad application because even animals who lack reflective understanding of knowledge can still feel surprise. In fact, the theory does something to explain why we even have this phenomenal feeling of surprise at all. It's pretty easy to see why biological creatures have the feeling of hunger, driving us to seek out energy, the feeling of pain, warning us against tissue damage. But what's going on with our having this surprise feeling? Curiosity isn't strictly necessary for knowledge gain. A creature who must interact with the environment to satisfy its basic extrinsic needs, such as thirst, will also gain when events violate its expectations. But what happens with creatures who have curiosity is that they benefit from a sort of adversarial interaction between the active, surprise-seeking force of their curiosity and the reactive prediction error correction mechanisms of natural biological learning. That internally adversarial interaction accelerates knowledge gain in ways that are extremely helpful for biological agents in environments like ours. So, before tackling questions about the mechanisms that enable curiosity and more abstract questions about the structure of curiosity itself, I think we can get a better sense of the target phenomenon by telling a bunch of anecdotes about animals. So I'm going to start with one of my favorite journal articles, Willard Small's 1899 classic, Notes on the Psychic Development of the Young White Rat. 10 out of 10 strong recommend. He insists that curiosity is the most striking of the animal's intellectual traits. And by 3 weeks of age, he says, curiosity is inordinate and it overbalances fear. He says that rats manifest curiosity apart from that curiosity which is directly associated with nutrition and reproduction. And that observation has held up very well under subsequent research. So exploratory behavior in the rat is not driven by immediate hunger because rats will actively explore mazes just after they've been fed. Indeed, the urge to explore is strong enough that hungry rats who are returned to their cages after being deprived of food for 24 hours will, and this is John Dashiell, give themselves up to explorations over and through their new bedding for a while before they will eat from an openly available bowl of food in their cage. Rats will also cross a floor that delivers a painful electric shock in order to explore new areas, and they'll do so when they're neither hungry nor thirsty. Exploratory behavior is not just random activity. Rats who've never been fed outside their cages will explore mazes systematically, showing a strong preference to visit the options where they haven't most recently been. So if they're relocated back to an earlier juncture, and last time they took the left-hand fork, they will, at much better than chance odds, take the right-hand fork this time. Rats can be taught specific routes or sequences of right and left turns to gain extrinsic reward. But what curiosity does, because it has them scrambling all over, is it prompts the development of a more powerful form of spatial navigation, a cognitive map. Routes have a value with a set beginning and end point, and the value is contingent on the reward of reaching that goal point. But maps can be pressed into service from any direction with no goal fixed in advance, enabling navigation along paths never taken before. In addition, maps are more robust in the face of environmental perturbations. If something goes down over here, you've just memorized a sequence of right and left turns, you're in trouble. But if you've got the cognitive map, you can do the reroute. The cognitive maps developed by rats are enriched to encode not just the spatial layout of the environment, but also its causal features. So to flesh out the causal side of the map, rats seem to exhibit curiosity in their motor interactions with material substances, exploring new materials unprompted and without any apparent prospect of material reward. So just as prior spatial exploration leads to mapping of a type that enables future navigation, prior material exploration equips rats with greater skill in future interactions with various materials. The representations formed through these two types of apparently curious exploration guide responses to unforeseen challenges and opportunities. Structurally similar types of cognitive mapping apply across a great range of task domains, including abstract non-spatial domains, including video games. They appear in a great range of animals, including humans. Animal curiosity is very hard to study, and if you want evidence of that, read that Glickman and Sroges article. It's a large-scale study of over 200 species of captive zoo animals. They gave them a bunch of useless objects, you know, a little wooden block, a chain, some rubber tubing, and, absolute chaos ensued, especially with the kangaroos. And it was just not clear how much of the behavior was driven by, you know, some kind of confusion about whether the provided objects were dangerous or edible or, in some cases, erotic. So you've got to sort of exclude these other lower level motivations to find, yes, the pure pursuit of knowledge. And to do that, it's been useful to have more systematic and controlled experimentation. And so here I'll just highlight some of Michael Kuba's great work on octopuses. They swiftly approached every object dropped into their surroundings. Aristotle noticed this. He saw it as a weakness. He says, the octopus is a stupid creature, for it will approach a man's hand if it be lowered in the water. Of course, contemporary cognitive scientists are like, the octopus is a genius, for it will approach a man. And that observation of Aristotle's has actually held up very well. If you drop anything into a tank with a captive octopus, it will approach, and then typically it will do some tactile fondling of what comes in. Kuba and colleagues, in one study, played around with putting in edible shellfish versus absolutely useless plastic cubes and snowflakes, little toys. Everything was approached. Most objects were explored with a tentacle or two. When the octopuses were very hungry, they were much more keen on manhandling the food than they were when they were sated. But they were equally enthusiastic about filling up the toys in either condition. And that looks like evidence that the toy touching isn't just what they call misplaced predation by an animal confused about what it can eat. And in fact, octopuses will go on to exhibit play behavior with toys, passing them from tentacle to tentacle and dragging their little plastic toys back and forth across the surface of the water, you know, toddler in the bathtub style. It's not clear what they're gaining from this. Why are they investing energy in these interactions with useless toys? If it's somehow making them smarter, that does help to explain how they can solve strategic reward problems that call on a precisely sequenced series of actions in order to gain food reward. So they're actually quite smart creatures. Jumping way across to another kind of animal, primates also show very strong sensory motor explorations. You can give them, this is Harlow's classic mid-20th century work, give them an elaborate mechanical puzzle that's solvable only by manipulating a series of clasps and levers and catches in exactly the right order. Rhesus monkeys will manipulate it avidly until they can solve it with high accuracy. And Harlow says, look, this produces a learning curve that, quote, doesn't appear to differ in any way from a typical learning curve obtained on animals under hunger or thirst motivation. That sequencing, difficult sequencing of fine motor skills, is learned with no reward other than the presumed satisfaction of finding a reliable way to open the innermost metal flap in a device that can be seen from the outside to contain no food. So, primates actually also seem to be willing to pay for information with no clear strategic value. So in gambling paradigms, rhesus monkeys are willing to forfeit some material reward, juice, to gain useless information about chance outcomes. And I think what's most striking, this is work by Wang and Hayden, the amount of juice they forfeit is proportional to the amount of information that they gain in the classic signal detection sense. So they pay more if the chance outcome in question is closer to that 50-50 gamble. Humans show some similar tendencies in ways that are much easier to probe because we can explicitly rate our level of curiosity. We can also report our level of surprise. And this is one source of evidence that surprise is generated by violations of expectation rather than, say, just sheer novelty. Ratings of surprise track the degree to which the triggering experience runs contrary to the subject's current beliefs. There's a review of this, the Rise and Sign review, kind of goes through all the data on it. Meanwhile, we report higher curiosity to see the early, to see the early resolution of gambles with greater outcome uncertainty given our beliefs. And indeed, we're willing to endure physical pain to see highly chancy but trivial matters resolved. So this is a really ingenious experiment by Christopher Shi, where participants were left in a room with a box containing some trick pens, you know, those clicking pens that kind of give you an electric shock. amid normal pens, the participants were ostensibly waiting for the beginning of another experiment. And the research assistant just mentioned, oh, these are left over from the last experiment that we're done, that we did. And there were three kinds of pens. 10 of them were marked with a red sticker to indicate that those would give you a shock if you clicked them. The researcher assistant then also explained that the 10 that were marked with a green sticker, those are duds, there's no battery in them, they will not shock you. And then there were 10 pens that were marked with a yellow sticker. And those were mixed, some shockers, some duds. So, left to their own devices, for 4 minutes, participants spontaneously clicked more of those yellow sticker uncertain outcome pens than the red and green ones put together. The unpredictability of the yellow sticker pens seems to be part of their allure, a little gamble each time. If you just wanted to alleviate boredom by, you know, having different kinds of stimulation, you could much more easily have just chosen red and or green pens at will. The study is an elegant demonstration, I think, of the force of pure curiosity, both because participants are willing to endure pain to gain knowledge that has zero practical value, and also because those red and green pens are just like tangible control stimuli, whose value seems to differ only in its predictability. I think it's really hard to explain what's going on in that Xi experiment while keeping in mind that curious humans do not have a chronic temptation to flip coins. I think this study also makes trouble for a number of philosophical theories of curiosity, including, for example, Peter Carruthers' latest theory, his new BJPS theory. In his view, I'm quoting, the core difference between intrinsically motivated states of questioning, like curiosity and interest on the one hand, and instrumentally motivated inquiries, is that the former, the curiosity ones, are appraised against long-standing interests and values, where the latter are appraised against current goals. So he has an example to illustrate this point, and it involves somebody who's like walking through a park, and she sees some kind of like motion in the underbrush. And her attention might be really drawn to that if she's the kind of person who's like a nature enthusiast. She likes to watch nature documentaries. She cares about the diversity of the natural world. And she initially fails to recognize that creature. She's going to have an effective state of curiosity on Carruthers' theory, sparked by prediction error. She's going to draw closer to examine it. Without that interest, Carruthers says, she might just ignore that disturbance and continue walking. I kind of like the example, except what's going on with the research participants who are clicking those yellow pens? Are they like pen fanciers or pain fanciers? I guess if they're pain fanciers, they'd go for the red ones. And what goals or underlying values drive the monkey who's spending hours manipulating Harlow's empty metal device or the octopuses with their plastic toys? These activities seem strangely independent of the ordinary goals of the agents involved, and maybe that independence from instrumental reward is an important feature of what makes curiosity its own intrinsic form of motivation and not just a diluted, weak sauce version of ordinary learning. I think Carruthers does have a point that not just any experience of something unknown will trigger that effective state of curiosity. But here I think we want an account with more predictive power to explain what does the trick. One robust pattern in human curiosity deserves special mention in this connection. So curiosity generally seems to be higher for questions in which we have a middling level of confidence. And that inverted, so if you're you know, absolutely certain of the pub quiz question, or you have absolutely no idea, you're not very curious about the answer. It's more if you're in that sort of like, I think I kind of know this one, I'm not sure. That inverted U-shaped curve shows up in a bunch of domains. For example, the trivia questions that are in the middle give you peak reported curiosity. That's Kang and colleagues. In the attentional patterns of infants, they're most attracted to moderately challenging events. tending to look away from anything that's either too simple or too complex, where complexity is a function of the predictability of the event, given the infant's prior experience. It's called sometimes the Goldilocks effect, seeking partial familiarity. It's a way of keeping cognitive resources engaged in the zone between what's already known and what's currently unknowable. And that looks like the zone most promising for progress in learning. So I think Carruthers Park case might be better explained by the observation that being something of a nature enthusiast is going to make our park visitor, it's going to make identifying the animal more of a manageable challenge for her. Perhaps it's like the structure of the learning challenge that really matters, not its content. There is, after all, something that the yellow pen clicker can very easily learn. So perhaps what's driving him is the abstract shape of the learning situation, not a mild interest in pens or shocks. Agents who have standing instincts to direct their cognitive resources towards manageable challenges will reach for those unpredictable pens, even if they themselves can see no value in advance of touching them. But maybe that's part of the beauty of curiosity. It's not tethered to your existing map of value. It takes you in directions whose intrinsic payoff is antecedently unknown. I need water. Let's talk about reinforcement learning. So, research in the branch of artificial intelligence known as reinforcement learning, RL, has clarified the importance of marshaling cognitive resources well. So, in RL, artificial agents discover through trial and error how to act in ways that tend to yield reward in artificially designed environments. As these environments become more realistic and more complex, it becomes increasingly important for the agents to make efficient use of their capacities to absorb and process information. RL research provides a clean slate for measuring differences between ways of controlling action and for testing the impact of supplying either the agent or the environment with various features. And one feature that you can add to an agent is some kind of intrinsic motivation for gaining knowledge. There are a bunch of ways of doing this, but I'm going to be suggesting that natural curiosity takes a very simple form. If even octopuses show signs of curiosity, you might wonder whether it's somehow essential to agency or essential to gaining knowledge of an environment. I'm going to argue that it isn't, and we'll see some completely incurious agents that gain knowledge incidentally in support of other goals. And in some environments, those incurious agents can perform optimally. So if curiosity-free knowledge acquisition is possible for agents motivated only by the pursuit of non-epistemic reward, you can wonder exactly what agents ever get from this added intrinsic motivation to pursue knowledge directly. To answer this question, we're going to look at environments and tasks where curious agents radically outperform their incurious rivals, and we'll see some commonalities with the natural world and with the sort of tasks that biological agents have to succeed at in order to thrive. So heads up, I'm going to talk about reinforcement learning artificial agents as knowing. But if you have qualms about that, you can just edit what I'm saying. Every time I say that they know something, you can say that they model an agent who knows something, right? Just add that in. I don't have time for that. I'm going to say, like, reinforcement learning researchers don't shy away from talk of knowledge. So, for example, this is Schmidhuber, classifies model-based agents as having, quote, an adaptive world model reflecting what's currently known by the artificial agent about how the world works, together with a learning algorithm that continually improves the model, detecting novel... the model is the thing that the agent has. Detecting novel, initially surprising spatiotemporal patterns that subsequently become known patterns. I'm going to grant there are a few researchers who resist talk of knowledge. For example, Selmer Bringsjord and colleagues, they start out by defining knowledge as true belief for which the subject can provide an explicit justification. Somebody didn't take philosophy as an undergrad. And Bringsjord contends that these RL agents, you know, Alpha Zero and stuff, they're not gaining knowledge because they can't produce these explicit justifications. And therefore, if learning is knowledge gain, then RL agents, reinforcement learning agents, never literally learn anything. But, you know, like as Cameron Buckner has pointed out, you want to go that way, you're also going to have the result that human learning is really limited, right? Do we learn to speak, to walk, and so on? So that doesn't look like a good way of going. I think the epistemology that works best here is a theory according to which knowledge is a mental state that's essentially factive, type of state whose correctness is necessary for its existence. So to see that RL agents can successfully achieve this kind of cognitive adaptation to their environments, we can start by taking a closer look at how it is they're supposed to learn. And here I'm just going to be following the Bible in this area, which is Sutton and Bardo's textbook, Reinforcement Learning, the 2020 edition. But I'd also strongly recommend a recent article by Julia Haas in Philosophy Compass called something like Reinforcement Learning for Philosophers, something like that. Great summary of what's going on. At the heart of reinforcement learning is an interaction between agent and environment. So the environment influences the agent causally by supplying the agent with a series of observations, and the agent influences the environment by producing a series of actions. The environment can be artificially simple. So it could be a tic-tac-toe game whose states are just grid configurations of X's and O's, or it can be arbitrarily complex. Observations are a signal of the state of the environment. Sometimes it's a very direct and complete signal, such as board positions in a game like chess. Sometimes it's something more complex, such as the array of pixel values in a, first-person shooter video game or something like that. Given the observations, the agent computes the current state at each turn. This is incredibly trivial in the tic-tac-toe case because the observations, that grid of X's and O's, that is your state. That's all you got there. In chess, it's slightly more complicated because the current snapshot of the board doesn't quite give you the state, because chess has rules about repetitions of board positions, and you've also got the one-time availability of the castling action. But if you had the whole stack of observations from the moment the game started, that actually does give you the complete state of the game right now. No surprises, nothing hidden, right? So that's what's called a fully observable environment. You're playing a video game. You've got actually just a partial signal of the environment, like you walk into the room and you don't know what's behind that door or whether this thing is going to, you know, you've got a lot of surprises awaiting in a video game. So it's actually often pretty hard to compute what state you're in. And of course, the sensory intake of a good video game is much richer and much more complex than the abstract positionality of tic-tac-toe or even chess. Where am I? Okay. So, when you're playing these games, or playing this game of navigating around meat space, patterns of past observations are needed to differentiate superficially similar situations which are fundamentally distinct. You could have in your game some doors which kind of look the same from the outside, but they lead to very different kinds of rooms. And you're going to have had past observations to distinguish those. You're also going to want to compress together superficially different looking situations which are fundamentally very similar, like different looking doors that lead to the same room, or the same door, different conditions of illumination, or something like that. So you've got to compress together relevantly similar states and differentiate relevantly different states, drawing on your whole pattern of experience. Because of inevitable limitations in memory, time, and computational power, agents in complex environments can't maintain a separate representation for each state, but they've got to discover classes of relevantly similar states through processes of generalization, discounting noise in the observational signal from the environment, and discarding features of observations that are irrelevant to action. So you've got a chess learning RL agent. Sometimes in the end game, there's like something it can do. It can mate into, given a certain configuration of pieces on the board. But you don't want it to have to do all the thinking all over again if there's like one trivial pawn moved over somewhere in the back where it's not making any difference, right? You just want it to kind of compress and recognize all those tiny variations is basically the same state. There's basically the same thing you're going to do here. Okay, so actions are selected in each computed state according to a rule known as the policy of the agent. The agent's policy dictates how it will act in a computed state by setting some probability distribution over the available actions for that state, even a completely random distribution. And that's actually a really good initial policy for an RL agent that's just starting out learning. It can just start out acting totally randomly. It's going to learn through trial and error. As time elapses, the agent's actions lead to new situations supplying fresh observations, including perhaps an experience of reward and new possibilities for action. So the experience of reward plays an absolutely decisive role in learning, in refining the agent's policy over time. Reward is a special type of observation. It's a scalar signal that serves as a target for the agent, like points in a video game for a player whose only goal is to maximize point score. Patterns of behavior basically that yield positive reward are reinforced. The reward signal can be distributed densely or sparsely among the other observations. So for example, in video games where the current score is displayed as a running tally, the score might either change frequently as time elapses or it just sticks at zero until you've made quite a bit of progress in the game. Either way, the reward signal is going to dictate what the agent will learn to do. Although learning's generally quicker in the presence of a dense reward signal, where you've got steady breadcrumbs of reward that are frequently updating the agent's evaluations of possible actions. And curiosity is going to turn out to be really important in situations with sparse reward. A central puzzle in goal-directed action is how future reward can have a bearing on the present moment of choice. In reinforcement learning, this puzzle is solved by the agent's evolving representation of value, a measure of the extent to which the immediately available actions in each state have historically tended to produce reward. The value of an action in a given state is not the reward this action immediately produces, but the total average long-term reward that it can be expected to lead to, conditional on the agent's policy, taking past experience as a guide and with usually a bit of temporal discounting. Crucially, when reward is finally encountered, the values assigned to the earlier state action pairs that led to it, those are then updated to reflect the later payoff. So over time, in environments where there are meaningful state action reward regularities to be discovered, repeated experimentation with different state action pairings allows the development of a meaningful representation of value through these backtracking computations of the ensuing reward. Effective algorithms use representations of value to guide agents to forego short-term gains and endure unrewarding actions in order to get to situations where larger rewards can be reaped. So you could have a really high value action that delivers no reward, such as the action of putting your piece in a position where now, no matter what your adversary does, you're going to be able to checkmate in two moves, right? You don't win the game by taking that move, but you put yourself on a path to reward. So that's going to be a very high value move. The computational backtracking of assigning high value to actions on paths that end up yielding reward is a species of prediction error learning. Projected reward estimates get revised over time to match reality. So this matching between assigned and real value ends up being modally robust, given the character of the training. An agent learning to play chess could start with nothing more than the rules of the game and rewards of plus one for a win, zero for a draw, minus one for a loss. Such an agent's initially random valuation of actions might by chance lead to a victory against a weak adversary, but the valuation isn't going to last on the strength of that accidental success. Where the agent would have lost if the adversary had played slightly differently. In the course of training, the agent initially relying on the random valuation is going to be pitted against multiple adversaries playing slightly differently. And it's going to have to be revising its valuation as it wins and loses. After millions of appropriately varied games, the agent's ranking of the value of moves in different types of situations will generally become reflective of their real tendency to promote victory, not least because the agent's compression of what counts as a relevantly different type of situation is going to be continually improving. So there's an initially blank slate agent of that type, Alpha Zero. This is back in 2018. It outperforms prior world champion AIs that were trained on human intelligence and human gameplay. Alpha Zero, as the name suggests, started with no input from human wisdom of chess at all. Chess is an absolutely enormous state space. So even the best agent isn't always going to know what to do. But Alpha Zero often knows which move to take. At least in many states later in the game, if Alpha Zero ranks one move over others, this valuation isn't just correct, it's safely correct. In the state Alpha Zero currently occupies, and indeed in any close state, the move that Alpha Zero represents as best is in fact best. It's on the branch to certain victory. In these cases of successful adaptation, the reason why Alpha Zero has stabilized on ranking one move best is that this move actually leads to victory in all relevantly similar predicaments. This safely accurate representation is therefore a fact of mental state. It's factive because its truth is what counts, is what accounts for its stable existence in the trained agent. And it's mental because of its role in guiding the agent's choice of move. So good policies favor actions that have shown high value for the relevant situation, exploiting what's been learned to date, together with some exploration of other actions to test whether undiscovered higher value elsewhere should prompt a further update to the policy. So one simple example of a good algorithm is the epsilon greedy policy, which just chooses a random exploratory action, some small percentage epsilon of the time. And otherwise, it always takes the greedy action, which is the action that's currently represented as having the highest valuation. More sophisticated policies can gradually explore less when the environment is better known, or in ways that are sensitive to what's at stake. Any effective policy is going to ensure that illusions are dispelled over time. State action pairs that are currently assigned high value will be revisited often because of that high valuation. But if they end up failing to yield high reward, their valuations will drop. So in biological learning, this process is known as extinction. And you have classic Pavlovian conditioning where the metronome is played just before meat is served and the dogs all salivate. If you stop serving meat right after playing the metronome, pretty soon that response goes away and the dogs stop salivating when they hear it. And that's important because extinction is a way that biological agents get protected against merely coincidental patterns of reward, and it's a way in which they can be sensitive to changes over time in the reward landscape. So the experience of reward precedes learning in this framework. Acting completely randomly, naive agents can stumble upon reward. Indeed, amnesiac agents who fail to learn anything can go on accruing some ongoing reward by chance. However, agents who learn from their reward capturing experiences are going to outperform random agents over time, assuming that there are regularities in the environment of types that the agents can exploit to form suitable action guiding mental states. The agent with a false or coincidentally true belief can act in a way that happens to yield reward on the basis of a current pattern of observations aligning with that belief. The agent with knowledge can act in a way that tends to yield reward on the basis of successful generalizations over its observations, where the truth of these generalizations explains their presence in the agent. Okay, sorry for all that. Let's add some curiosity. Now we're going to make it fun. All reinforcement learning agents have to explore in order to bring their subjective valuations into line with objective reality. As long as the environment isn't yet fully known, agents have to explore to avoid being trapped in local optima where greater undiscovered reward lies elsewhere. What is curiosity? In the words of Marc Bellemare, curiosity aims to provide qualitative guidance for exploration. If you don't have any qualitative guidance at all, you're just, taking you're on Epsilon Greedy, you're taking, 19 instrumental moves, pursuing your best possible conception of reward, and every 20th move you just roll the dice and do something random. That can be kind of wasteful, right? The random exploratory action when you roll the dice could be an action that's actually already, exploring, opening a box that you've opened many times before, right? And perhaps there are some important zones that are further away that are somehow being left unexplored. You can have simple count-based methods that just add reward for visiting rarely visited states. You've got some spots out there, haven't been to them lately. You get a bonus point of reward if you go scout them out. But those are going to be best for small deterministic domains where you're ultimately going to have a chance to go to all the spots, with states that are likely to be visited multiple times. And also, those count-based methods require the reward allocation function to consult memory with each exploratory action. It's like, hey, have I been here before? Let me think of my entire life. To check which options have already been explored and how often. For agents like us, better qualitative guidance for exploration is summarized as, this is Belmar again, explore what surprises you. Rather than demanding a memory check, reward can be allocated simply for the experience of events that violate the agent's expectations. As an illustration of the contrast here, let's think of Schmidt-Huber's television. It gives you a novel, previously unvisited state every second that you look at it. But it's unsurprising because you don't have any expectations for how it's going to be looking that could be violated. Stimuli with partial familiarity, on the other hand, set up some expectations that can be proven wrong, generating prospects for surprise, right? And if you think of, alluring television shows, right? They give you those plot twists, she seems so innocent. Oh my God, no, she's a double agent, right? And the most curiosity satisfying ones are the ones where you can't quite predict the plot twist in advance, but it makes sense in retrospect. Okay, in general, agents who experience surprise as reward, they do better if they're making predictions involving lasting features of the environment, as opposed to predictions of raw sensory stimulation, for reasons that Deepak Pathak and colleagues spell out as follows. And I feel like there's something kind of deep here that interacts with problems in logical empiricism from last century, but we can talk about that later. So here he's talking about these reinforcement learning agents who are playing hard video games. And he says, this quote is on your handout. I love this quote. Making predictions in the raw sensory space is undesirable, not only because it's hard to predict pixels directly, but also because it's unclear if predicting pixels is even the right objective to optimize. To see why, consider using prediction error in the pixel space as a curiosity reward. Now imagine a scenario where the agent is observing the movement of tree leaves in a breeze. Since it's inherently hard to model breeze, it's even harder to predict the pixel location of each leaf. This implies the pixel prediction error will remain high, and the agent will always remain curious about the leaves. But the motion of the leaves is inconsequential to the agent, and therefore its continued curiosity about them is undesirable. The underlying problem is that the agent is unaware that some parts of the state space simply can't be modeled. And thus the agent can fall into an artificial curiosity trap and stall its exploration. So I think the pixelated moving leaves present actually a couple different problems. First, they're forming patterns that are too complex for the agent to master. And second, their motion is an inconsequential feature of the environment. The agent isn't gaining any extrinsic reward, not solving the task by standing there transfixed by the leaves. So to protect agents from such fruitless curiosity traps, Pathak and colleagues transform the sensory input in their model into a feature space just representing aspects of the environment relevant to action. I can explain question period later if you're curious how they do this. Having learned the feature space, so this is like what are the underlying causes of these sensory experiences I'm having, the agent then learns a forward dynamics model that predicts how things will turn out in that feature space when it acts. and it gets reward for those actions whose outcomes are contrary to its predictions. I don't know what's going to happen if I do this thing, right? So in difficult 3D video game navigation tasks, PathX Curious RL agents outperform rivals that are trained only on extrinsic game point reward. In contrast to randomly exploring agents who just get stuck in loops of local minima, these curious agents who, you know, they want to do things that where they don't know what's going to happen. What's going to happen when I open that door? The curious agents swiftly learn to navigate hallways systematically. They visit many rooms and large mazes. They can avoid crude white noise curiosity traps. They're not going to get stuck staring at the pixelated leaves. They actually, unfortunately, remain vulnerable to curiosity traps of other sorts, though. In particular, if they get the power to generate stochastic events such as coin flips, or if you are very unkind and give one of them a remote control that it can press to change the display on a TV randomly, it's going to get stuck there flipping the channels. Generating reward for itself by repeatedly witnessing these mildly surprising actions within their control, and it ceases larger exploration progress within the game. Okay, I think it's a good question how animals harvest the benefits of curiosity without getting stuck in the traps. If surprise functions as reward, reinforcement learning will teach agents to forego small short-term surprises in favor of actions with the potential to produce more surprise in the long term. So this is like, it's a little bit of a desperate move because I'm not sure it works, but I'm thinking maybe interacting with the pens in Xi's experiment differs from coin flipping in the following respect. You flip the coin, it's one and done with no implications for future anything. But if you click the pen, you get to classify it. This one's a shocker, or this one's a dud. Right now, it's a lasting part of your world model. Having categorized it one way or the other, that creates further expectations that could later be violated, right? Yielding additional possibilities for later surprise. If, for example, a shocker pen at some point ceases to shock. And just like more generally, stronger long-term expectations can be produced by actions that reveal broader patterns of underlying causal structure. So, for example, in the patterns of explanation, seeking, questioning, and causal experimentation that start very early in human development that researchers like Tanya Lombroso have been exploring in it, her co-author, I think, Emily Liquin. Theories with greater generality create the possibility for surprising counterexamples. So actions that tend to lead to the formation of such theories, other things equal, will be reinforced. Without reflection, state action pairs are just going to seem good to an agent when similar state action pairs have in the past led to surprise. More strategically, agents who can anticipate that they don't know what will happen when they act a certain way, they'll be drawn to do so. As for avoiding traps, it should be conceded that sometimes humans do get stuck flipping channels, going through all those things on Netflix, or playing mildly surprising but pointless games. Human self-consciousness could give our curiosity the kind of strategic form that would keep us from dwelling too much on low-level chancy events. Artificial agents, actually, can be made more human-like. So this is some fabulous work by Nick Haber and colleagues. They can be structured to develop both a world model predicting the consequences of the agent's action and a self model that tracks the type of situations in which the world model fails. So those agents can choose larger sequences of action where the world model can be expected to fail, systematically expanding the boundaries of the agent's knowledge. Okay, the question of why biological agents need curiosity can now be addressed much more directly. Knowledge can be gained even if it's not actively pursued. The basic mechanisms of reinforcement learning work for agents driven strictly by extrinsic reward. So AlphaZero is such an agent. Its reward function is so simple. +1 for a win, -1 for a loss, 0 for a draw, and it cares about absolutely nothing else. It's completely incurious. In the course of its training, this completely incurious agent nevertheless develops extensive, superhuman knowledge of how to play chess. A relevant feature of chess is that it's a fully observable environment in which you've got roughly 40 moves per side in a game. Whenever AlphaZero acts, it's not long before the environment supplies instructive feedback on its success or failure. By contrast, the natural world is very much a partially observable environment with extrinsic rewards such as food, only sparsely distributed among a massive flood of other sensory signals, which in turn provide only limited information about the local causal reality. So this is a sparse reward scenario we're living in right here. And incurious agents do poorly in those. So for example, if you take, take not AlphaZero, but take its successor, MooZero, which is really a killer. It plays not just chess, it plays Go, it plays all kinds of games. It can crush us at tons of games, including in the Atari suite. It can play Pong or Breakout, or it can absolutely shut us down in terms of how well it plays games. If you ever have to play a game against it, I have a suggestion for a game you might want to choose. We do better at games of long-range strategic exploration. So there's, in the Atari suite, a game called Montezuma's Revenge. Has anyone played? Does anyone know this game? Okay, so you're navigating this like 99-room labyrinth, and you've got to like pick up keys and climb ladders and do all these things to get rewards that come along much later. And in fact, to get the first reward, you've got to go through this path. There's ladders, you have to jump over a skull. If you're just acting completely randomly, you're going to get that first reward one out of every 500,000 times you play. An average human scores about 4,700 points in Montezuma's Revenge. MooZero, for all its chess prowess, is unable to score a single point after a million rounds of training because it just got that pure focus on game score. It doesn't like, oh, that's cool, there's a key, what should I do with that? It doesn't think that way. Curious reinforcement learning, however, does really well at Montezuma's Revenge. In case you were thinking this was going to be some kind of argument for human superiority, no. You just have to like tweak the algorithm. So Yuri Berta and colleagues have some great work on intrinsically curious RL agents. So one reason why curiosity is helpful in partially observable environments is that it is up to the exploring agent to decide what to explore. And under pressure, time pressure, and in a changing world, it's really important not to waste time exploring what's already known. Another reason relevant to biological agents is that curiosity can scaffold the pursuit of extrinsic rewards such as nourishment, whose acquisition in a competitive environment might require extended sequences of action. So Gianluca Baldessare describes the challenge posed by sparse extrinsic reward scenarios as follows, quote, I think this is on your handout. Learning mechanisms of animals fail to function when there are long delays between the performed behaviors and the learning signals that they cause. Moreover, there are few chances to produce, by trial and error, complex behaviors and long action chains that result in a positive impact on homeostatic needs, hunger, thirst. As a consequence, complex behaviors and chains would never be learned based simply on extrinsic motivations. The fact that biological learning mechanisms fail after long delays, that's not something that's easily overcome. We need processes of forgetting and extinction to keep us up to date in a changing environment. However, if curiosity can deliver knowledge of lasting features of the environment that are only indirectly relevant to extrinsic reward, these can function as what Baldessare describes as readily available building blocks that can support complex actions later as needed. In complex environments, animals who experience primary, that is unlearned reward, only for nourishment and reproductive actions, those animals will be outperformed by animals who also experience primary reward for knowledge gain. Under the pressure of natural selection, we can expect curiosity to be a favored trait in the primary reward functions or natural instincts of animals who might need to learn complex behaviors to satisfy their other needs. That last idea is from a brilliant paper by Satinder Singh and colleagues from 2010. Now, Baldessari was the theorist who spoke of the direct detection of levels of knowledge in the brain. He did so in a passage distinguishing extrinsic motivations such as thirst from intrinsic motivations such as curiosity. In his view, the extrinsic motivations use fitness proxies in the visceral body, and the intrinsic motivations like curiosity use fitness proxies in the brain. Extrinsic motivations trigger innate and learned behavior to keep the animal within safe homeostatic limits. In either case, and when intrinsic motivations use proxies properly inside the brain, like with surprise, that feeling of surprise, that's a fitness proxy. In either case, these proximal mechanisms work to secure the distal aim of enhancing fitness. So thirst makes you drink, as curiosity makes you investigate. The adaptive function of thirst is not to produce a certain ion concentration in neurons outside the blood-brain barrier, but it's to maintain the fluid balance of the whole body to optimize cell function. The proxy can come apart from the target, for example, in thirst-disrupting diseases. But when all is well, the reward signals of thirst ensure that animals can learn behaviors that keep their bodies appropriately hydrated. On the side of curiosity, when the brain detects significant discrepancies between expectation and actuality, the resultant feelings of surprise serve as markers of knowledge gain, generating the pleasure of discovery. Strictly speaking, what's detected in the brain is surprise, not knowledge. However, this signal exists because it naturally signifies knowledge gain. Again, the proxy can sometimes come apart from the target, like when surprising delusions prompt the formation of false beliefs. The adaptive function of curiosity is not to produce surprise signals in the brain, but to motivate animals to act in ways that generally accelerate their accumulation of knowledge, an acceleration that seems to be vital for the survival of organisms in challenging environments such as ours. Having argued that surprise works to guide animals towards knowledge, I want to close by mentioning a special way in which this works for our species in particular. The most characteristic expression of human curiosity is to ask questions. Many animals communicate, but we're the only animal that questions and engages in interactive conversation, asking and telling. It's interesting that when someone does tell us something we didn't already know, we overtly express surprise. Oh, wow. A feedback signal whose function deserves investigation. While other animals accelerate their knowledge gain through privately surprising, curiosity-driven investigation, exploration of their spatial environment and the physical materials it contains, we go beyond this by publicly expressing surprise as we interactively explore each other's states of mind in conversation in a way that's frequently curiosity-driven, or so I'm going to argue next week. As a result, we gain some cognitive mapping of what others know, enabling us to engage in strategic harvesting of their knowledge. The next two lectures are going to examine the structures in social cognition that enable this mapping, starting with structures shared with other animals, and then advancing to structures that are distinctive of humanity. Thank you.